It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. When faced with an abusive partner, many women seek out a protection from abuse order to get protection and regain control over their lives. But according to a new study from the University of Pittsburgh, getting out of an abusive relationship can be quite costly for women who try to obtain PFAs. Sociologists Melanie Hughes and Lisa Brush join us now to address the financial disruption of women's lives when they petition the courts to leave abusive relationships. Melanie Hughes, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
And Lisa Brush, good to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Paul.
And we'd like to put the question out there to our listeners. Did abuse or the process of obtaining a restraining order, or PFA, as they are called, have a major financial impact on someone you know? Call us, 412-246-2002, the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm or on Twitter at esspgh. And again, 412-246-2002. So the first question I think we probably need to look at is, would you describe the study and what were your goals or what research question were you trying to find answers to?
Research shows that abuse jeopardizes not just women's health and their bodily welfare, but also their education and their employment. Women who suffer abuse at the hands of their current and former husbands and boyfriends face employment instability and reductions in work hours, job experience, and even their wages. Now, one way that women can try to put an end to that abuse and to mitigate its costs is to petition for a civil restraining order against their abuser. And now, research does show that restraining orders can promote women's safety and help women and their advocates manage the threat of abuse. So plausibly, restraining orders could also put an end to the many ways that abuse obstructs women's work. But we simply didn't know whether that was the case.
So you set out to find some answers to the questions. And it's sort of like Jeopardy. You're trying to come up with not necessarily the answer, but the right question, right, Lisa?
Right. And what we really wanted to understand was if we compared women to themselves before and after they went through the process of petitioning, did they experience a boost in their earnings and an increase afterwards in the wake, right? So it was somehow the petition was effective in stopping the abuse or in helping them use employment to increase their economic independence? Or was there an economic shock or a stall in their earnings? And in fact, we found out that the period right around the time when they're petitioning is full of all kinds of turmoil, and pretty much everybody experiences a shock, and lots of women experience a stall in their earnings.
So obviously we're familiar with the idea that getting legal help has costs, but your study focuses primarily on lost income. Why did you choose to focus on earnings?
We looked at earnings partly because that was the data that we could get a hold of. So, but the more serious answer to that question is the fact that in this culture, we think of work as being the silver bullet for everything, right? We think of work as being the silver bullet to stop abuse because we think that if women have economic independence, then they will be able to better bargain over their safety and the safety of their children, or they will be able to exit an abusive relationship. And we know from a lot of other research that work is sometimes the actual terrain of abuse. And we wanted to understand what happened to the pattern of women's earnings during this period of upheaval that might be associated with petitioning for a PFA.
When you say that work is the terrain of abuse, how do you mean that?
There are a lot of ways that abusers can sabotage women's work. And they generally do it as a way of reducing women's economic independence, as a way of micromanaging their conformity with norms about gender. So the abuser may take the woman's earnings or may threaten to hurt or harm her when she takes a step that might increase her earnings, might destroy her opportunities, could, you know, shoplift from her employer, could come and actually abuse her on the job. And so there are a lot of different ways that abuse can interfere with women's work. And we were hoping that a PFA would get between the abuse and the women's work effort. But it turns out that work isn't necessarily the silver bullet.
412-246-2002 if you want to join our conversation with sociologists Melanie Hughes and Lisa Brush, talking about the seeking of protection from abuse orders and women trying to regain control over their lives, trying to get out of abusive relationships. And let's go to the phones. We have Carla in Pittsburgh on the line. Carla, welcome to the conversation. You're on with Melanie Hughes and Lisa Brush.
Hi, everyone. Yes, my name is Carla. I'm calling from Pittsburgh, and I stepped out of work. I work at the Women's Center and Shelter of Greater Pittsburgh, but I myself am also a survivor of domestic abuse. And I was just kind of shocked to find this discussion, and I'm very grateful for it. I did not seek a PFA for personal reasons, but extracting myself from that relationship was totally and utterly financially devastating for me. I left with nothing, and still 6 months later, I am rebuilding. And I just can't stress how much it negatively affected my life, even the process of getting out.
Yeah, and that is totally consistent with what we found. We really want to applaud your courage, and we think that one of the most important implications of our research is has to do with the fact that women who are petitioning and who are making every effort to make themselves safe and make their kids safe need economic support during the incredibly tumultuous period of the petitioning, but also they may need help for an extended period of time afterwards. The short-term shock was significant, but the longer-term stall was also significant.
And Carla,
very true.
That's okay. I'm sorry to jump in, but I was going to ask this question of our expert sociologists in the studio, but I think that you can actually shed some light for us on this if you like. The study that Melanie Hughes and Lisa Brush have undertaken finds that petitioning the courts often results in instability or a disruption in women's lives. What does that instability look like on a sort of day-to-day basis? As someone who has just lived through this, Carla, maybe take us through, you know, if you care to, you know, how this impacts you or has impacted you day-to-day for the last 6 months.
Well, I did not petition the courts, but I was involved in a court hearing because the first time that my abuser was physical with me, it was very bad. And he went to jail. There was a series of court dates extending several months where I was to appear in court and testify. That was very disruptive to my work life, and it was extremely disruptive to my emotional life because every time I had to go to court, I had to see him and had to relive it. And it was among the hardest moments of my life. Were you asking me like what it looks like day to day, the financial implications?
Yeah.
It's everything. I left when I finally left, I left in the middle of the night with, you know, everything that I could stuff into a garbage bag and my computer. And that was all I took with me. And that was all I started with. I stayed in two shelters. First, the Women's Center and Shelter. Sorry, there's a truck going by. I have to have my windows down because it's so nice. And then I stayed at one in McKeesport. And when I moved from the one in McKeesport to my first apartment, and I sat in that room with nothing. I slept on a broken futon. And it was so bleak. And it's taken me 6 months to really start to even build the basic infrastructure of my life once again, you know, buying a bed, buying sheets. And I am lucky. I turned off the story because I was waiting and I didn't want, like, the resonance in the background. But I did hear when you guys were talking about the benefit of work, I was one of the only women in those shelters who had a job at the time. I was waiting tables. And that job was just a godsend to me. I don't know how I would have made it through if it weren't for that job. And now, by twist of some magnificent grace, I have the opportunity to work at the shelter, which means the world to me. But it's been a long process, and I'm not done yet. I still have a lot to replenish in my life.
Well, Carla, as you were sharing your story with us, and we appreciate it, and I as I listen to you, I'm sorry to hear what you've had to go through, but encouraged, as I'm sure others are, by how you have persevered and begun the process of putting your life back together, as it were. And as you were starting your story with us, Lisa was nodding, and I'm guessing that this is that Carla's tale is not altogether uncommon.
Carla's tale is very typical, although the issue of work is super important in many, many women's lives, but the disruption is what's typical and is part of the finding here. So we're, Carla, very, very glad that you've gotten yourself out of the relationship with the abuser and that you're on your way. And we're very interested in finding ways of making that transition less devastating. And one of the ways that we can do that is by making sure that women have the resources that they need when they're trying to exit from relationships, which of course we know is one of the most dangerous points in women's lives of trying to extricate themselves from abuse.
Yes. One of the things that I wanted to say, and please stop me if you've already said this, but for women who don't have maybe the resources that I did because I had a job, the Women's Center and Shelter provides a plethora of resources, from pro bono legal aid if you are seeking to file a PFA, to also relocation assistance. You do not have to be a resident of the shelter in order to receive these resources. All you have to do is be involved in their services in some way. They have support groups, if you're a member, which are wonderful, wonderful. I was a member of the support group until I joined the staff there, and it was a huge part of my healing process. If you're a member of the support groups and you need it, you can avail yourself of their relocation assistance. They have a lot of resources available for women who need them.
Carla, so, I want to thank you for that information. We have information on the Women's Center and Shelter on the website, as well as the Center for Victims, so people can find that little one-stop shopping if they go to our website at WESA.FM. Carla, thank you for sharing that information and your story with us.
Thank you so much for the discussion. I really appreciate it.
It's our pleasure. And I would ask our guests, Melanie and Lisa, the financial challenges that end up leading women, could financial challenges, women's decisions to seek restraining orders that bring about the financial challenges, could they end up leading women to stay in dangerous circumstances? Melanie?
Yes, I think that we do know that economics play into women's decision making as they're trying to decide, am I able to leave this relationship? Can I afford to move out? To many of these women live with the people who are abusing them, and they may need to find alternate housing. They may need to have resources for medical. There's a number of financial obstacles for women to leave these situations, and we know that for when they seek court assistance to put a stop to the abuse, they may need a number of other economic supports to help them through these difficult situations.
Let's take another call from Barbara, calling from Standing Firm. Barbara, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello.
Hi. You're on with sociologist Melanie Hughes and Lisa Brush. Good to have you with us.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Oh.
Much better.
Okay, now you can hear us. Go ahead with your comment or question then.
Yes, hi. I'm calling as the associate director of a local nonprofit initiative called Standing Firm, the Business Case to End Partner Violence. And I just wanted to alert those in the employer community that there are significant and effective action steps that employers can undertake that will aid women who are victims of partner violence, that help both the victims in their ability to maintain their employment through what are sometimes small steps on the part of the employer, and also to maintain a long-term, more positive work environment for the employer as well. In other words, not losing good employees to personal situations. And the work of Standing Firm has been...
Barbara, I'm going to jump in because we have a link to Standing Firm. So if people want to get information, they can go to WESA.FM and find that. But it sounds like that's another resource for people who are in need.
That employers can take to help victims and also help themselves as employers.
Barbara, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. Melanie Hughes, Lisa Brush, your study, and again, we're talking with two sociologists from the University of Pittsburgh who have, according to their study, who have undertaken this study, and according to the study, getting out of an abusive relationship can be quite costly for women who try to obtain protection from abuse orders. Your study seems to suggest that the protective orders are inadequate. How are they inadequate?
Well, I think it's important to note that the protection orders themselves are not necessarily causing the declines in earnings, right? We find that the time surrounding women's petitioning is an incredibly unstable time for them financially. So women are trying to take off time from work to go to court, to seek medical attention. They may need to take time off work to look for safe and affordable housing. And a protection order is not going to help women through that process. They need to access other resources to help them through that. So many of the women that we are studying are working in, they may not be working at all, or so they may need to go to work in order to have the financial resources. But many of them are also in low-wage jobs or simply hourly employment. So any time that they're taking off from work, it means that's lower earnings at a time where they may need even more resources in order to establish new housing and so on. So what we need is to have financial resources for women available during this incredibly unstable time.
But is there also some way to ensure that women are not going to continue to be abused? Because these protection orders, while they can be helpful, they don't always guarantee that the abuse is going to stop.
That's right. That's a problem with the notion that We think that work is the silver bullet, right? We think that if we get women economic independence, they'll be able to earn their way out of vulnerability to abuse. And the broader message here is that that's not necessarily the case. And it's not that the protective order or petitioning for a protective order is causing the economic instability. It's that the abuse and the women's efforts to end the abuse are accompanied by tremendous economic instability, and that's the problem, and that's what we need to be supporting women. Melanie?
Go ahead, Melanie.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on that to say that we often think of civil restraining orders as effective tools to stop abuse, and that might be the case in some situations. But in other situations, women actually taking steps to end the abuse can actually cause abusers to ratchet that abuse up, right? It can cause a backlash effect. So the very abuse that's getting in the way of women working may increase when women petition the courts for help rather than decrease or simply continue. So we can't necessarily assume that when women petition the courts for help, that the abuse is going to stop or lessen.
So what kinds of things can be done to minimize the disruption to women's income and financial stability?
Well, as Barbara was pointing out, there are things that employers can do. And the options that Standing Firm is providing for employers to think about for increasing the safety in the workplace and reducing the kinds of interference and sabotage with work are very important. It also turns out, we found in our study, that women who are receiving welfare see a moderation of the negative economic effects of petitioning. So welfare as an economic resource can be quite important for women. Of course, it's only available to very low-income women, and it has a work requirement tied to it now and time limits tied to it. And so one of the other things that we can perhaps be doing through social policy to be offering these women more options is to be making sure that there is a clear exemption for women who are abused from the time limits and work requirements on that additional support.
Let's take one last call from Joe in Hopewell. Joe, we are over our time limit for this segment, so if you can be as quick as you possibly can, we would appreciate it.
Yes, I worked in domestic relations out of college and learned all about this, and I got to tell you, I also got a chance to go to the Liberace Museum, and they taught me how Mrs. Liberace had to raise her sons, and the father refused to make a living and would actually sabotage her alarm clock so she'd lose her jobs. And I learned it there, but I can tell you this, you have to support women's shelters. We have to get more scholarships for people in that situation, and she's so right. I also eventually ran that courthouse that I actually worked at when I was out of college years later, and we had a lot of women abuse. You have to have a policy where the employers actually work and understand this very complicated issue. It's not easy to understand, and it's even harder to solve.
Joe, thank you for that call. I'll end with this question. Do you see, Melanie or Lisa, do you see similar economic instability when it comes to men who are abused by a partner?
We didn't use any of the data that we have. We were able to look at women who were subjected to a countersuit. So women who the abusive partner also filed a petition against them. But this study just focused on the data that we have on the women.
University of Pittsburgh sociologists Melanie Hughes and Lisa Brush joining us. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you to the callers who commented and shared their stories with us.
Yeah, thank you, Paul, and thank you, Carla and Barbara.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up, how can victims of abuse obtain protection from abuse orders? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. There are times when relationships can take a dangerous turn, requiring one of the parties to seek legal protection. This can result in the obtaining of a PFA, or Protection from Abuse Order. However, having one is not a guarantee of safety. Joining us in Studio A to discuss the steps necessary to get a PFA and who can get them is attorney Lisa A. Borelli-Dorn. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Who can obtain a protection from abuse order?
Well, Paul, anyone can obtain one if they're suffering from abuses as defined under the Pennsylvania law. If they're over the age of 18 or if they're under the age of 18 and they have an adult guardian file on their behalf. The abuser has to be one of several categories, a spouse or a former spouse, a current or a former sexual or intimate partner, a current or former cohabitant, a family member related by blood, such as a sister or a brother, or a family member related by marriage or affinity, like a stepsister or stepbrother, a parent of a child with a defendant, the child of the plaintiff, or a child of the defendant. They can be any one of those categories, but they have to be one of those categories in order to get it. Otherwise, you're going to have to file a criminal charge.
Tell us about the types of protection from abuse orders. There are different
varieties. There are three types. By the way, you can also get one against a same-sex partner, in case anyone's wondering about that. But there's an emergency PFA. There's a temporary ex parte PFA, and then that leads to the permanent PFA. An emergency one is one that happens imminently. So you go to the district magistrate, you go to the night court, or you go to the family division, you file a short form, and it's heard immediately by the magistrate or a little bit later by the judge, and it's granted, but it's only good for 24 hours. It's only good until the courts open. Then you have to go down to the family division and file for a temporary ex parte PFA. And that's the one where you're going to have a hearing. Now, ex parte is Latin, and it basically means that you're going to be testifying without the defendant being there. So you're going to tell your story to the judge, and they're going to decide whether or not to grant you the temporary PFA. That PFA is only good for 10 days, and it basically gets you to a hearing. And the hearing's where you're going to have to present witnesses and documentation, and you're going to be facing the abuser there.
So we have a question on the list here, which is who is responsible for granting a PFA order? And I think you just answered that. It's the man sitting with the gavel.
Right.
Or woman sitting with the gavel.
The man or woman sitting with the gavel, exactly. And only a judge can grant a temporary and a final. But a magistrate or the night court magistrates, they can do the emergencies. And the important thing is that you have to be there. You have to be there and present it. Now, if you're in the hospital and you're still in fear of imminent danger, they have something that's kind of like Skype, where they fax over the form and the magistrate sees you and you see him and you can present your testimony. The key question, though, that has to be answered in the positive is, are you in fear of your life? And that's the question that most women or men or abused individuals need to make sure that they can answer yes to and answer it honestly.
So walk us further through the process then, because there's more to it in terms of what people needing to know what to expect.
Right. And essentially what's going to happen on the emergency basis is you're going to walk in and there's a short form to fill out. It has, you know, you're going to put your name, your address, if you want to release it. If it's confidential, you're not going to put that down, your age. And then you're going to put down anybody else that you're filing it for. And then a brief synopsis of what happened recently. They don't want history there. They just want, this is what happened recently. You know, this is my medical bills. This is how it goes. And that's going to go right in front of the magistrate. And he's going to rule right then and there on that after the form's filled out. Now, if you, you're also going to have to do the most important thing. You're going to have to provide an address for the abuser or the defendant. They're going to need his name, his age, and his address. And they need to be able to have that so that they can serve the document. Because if it can't be served, it's not going to be effective. So they have to find the abuser and they have to give him the PFA so that he knows that he can't come near you.
And we talked in the previous segment about how the PFA, the Protection from Abuse Order, it doesn't always do what it is intended to do. So talk about what a PFA can do for you? Who does it protect? And why do we see a breakdown in this process sometimes?
Okay. Well, it protects the filer and any minor children or other people residing in the home with them. What it can do, if everything's going the right way, is it can order the abuser to stop abusing, stop harassing, stop stalking your relatives or your minor children or you. It can order the abuser to be removed from the home where you live. So it's like an eviction notice. It can award temporary custody or visitation. It can order the abuser to pay financial support. It can do all these things, as well as prohibit the abuser from having any contact with you, your work, your children's daycare. It can order the abuser to turn over any firearms so that there's no weapons. And it can order the abuser to pay for reasonable losses that you may have sustained resulting from the abuse. Now, whether a judge orders any or all of this depends on the facts of your case and how well you present them.
But even if the judge orders these things, we hear all the time about the abusers getting around the provisions. They're ordered to do any number of things that they don't do. Why does that happen?
Well, it happens for a number of reasons. The first reason that it happens for is, you know, as soon as it's happening, you need to call the police, because a lot of times they need to see that something's going wrong in order to arrest. They can't really arrest based on your statement of things unless, of course, there's evidence like, you know, a physical bodily harm. So that sometimes slips through. And abusers are very smart people usually. They're very controlling. They know a lot of things. So, you know, if your doors are unlocked, they can sneak in. So you need to be very, very careful about your person. You know, you have to make sure that the people who need to have the PFA have it. You need to make sure that you know, if you're in the home by yourself, that the doors are locked. You want to make sure that you always have a cell phone with you. I mean, there's no guarantees. So the only thing you can really do is protect yourself. It's a piece of paper, and when it's used properly, it can help you. But a lot of times it's too late. The abuse has already occurred, and then you need to file another paper, a criminal contempt paper. And sometimes people don't do that. And sometimes judges don't grant them. So there's a couple things that you can do to make sure. You know, sometimes the PFA doesn't cover certain things. So when you go to get it, you got to review it, make sure it says the right things. And you got to make sure copies are given to everybody. You need to make sure that, you know, you've mentioned weapons to the judge and weapons are taken away. And I found a lot of ideas on womenslaw.org for safety, for women's safety. And the one thing that you also have to do is if you're sharing a home and you're on the internet, you need to erase your history. You know, erase all the places that you've been and put in boring things like, you know, recipes and how to clean things. Stuff that an abuser probably would look at and just dismiss, or go to the library. You know, if something's happening, you need to respond right away. You can't respond afterwards. You kind of have to yell for help. You have to dial your cell phone. You have to put 911 in there. You know, little things like make sure your gas is full of, you know, your tank in your car is full of gas so that you can get away. Make sure that you practice getting away. Make sure you have your important papers tucked in safe places.
We're talking with attorney Lisa A. Borelli-Dorn about PFAs, protection from abuse order. And what might keep someone from obtaining a PFA?
Oh, there are lots of reasons. Fear of the abuser and the repercussions of filing. If it's not granted, it can make things worse. Fear of the system, fear of the courts, or even maybe having the stigma of having to get one. Maybe having nowhere to go. Maybe not knowing that there are shelters out there that can help you. Could be just a part of the cycle of abuse and those helpless feelings that abused individuals often get, maybe not knowing how to do it.
Do the authorities provide additional safeguards?
Honestly, probably not. You know, if the authorities have a copy of it, sometimes they can drive by more frequently, but they can't be your personal protection. They're going to need you to call them as soon as something's going down. Now, if you have a PFA that's being violated, again, you got to call 911 immediately. And if they arrest the individual, then there's a process for that. They'll file a contempt hearing, and the accused could go to jail. If they don't file arrest If they don't arrest the defendant immediately, then you can take a copy of your PFA down to your magistrate office or the night court, and you can file a complaint for indirect criminal contempt for violation of the PFA order, and the judge can grant that. Night court can do that, and oftentimes they'll schedule a magistrate hearing.
And so the website, again, that you mentioned?
Was for safety issues, was women.
We definitely want to help people get that. And
yeah.
We can put a link to it at our website at WESA.FM. But again, that website was?
The website was.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Trick
That's
question.
Okay. A trick question. Womenslaw.org.
Okay, womenslaw.org. We'll have a link on our website at WESA.FM. Attorney Lisa A. Borelli-Dorn telling us about the ins and outs of protection from abuse orders. I think you've given us a pretty illuminating background and a lot of information here. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Coming up, we'll turn to March Madness. The Robert Morris University men's basketball team is going to the big dance. We'll talk with Colonials head coach Andy Toole. That's next on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. For the first time since 2010, the Robert Morris University men's basketball team is going back to the NCAA Division I tournament. The Colonials qualified for the big dance by beating St. Francis of New York in the Northeast Conference Tournament Championship game. And last night, they received the official word that they'll face North Florida in a play-in game Wednesday night in Dayton, Ohio. I'm joined now by phone by Andy Toole, the head basketball coach at Robert Morris. Coach, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh and congratulations.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
This is your first appearance as head coach in the NCAA basketball tournament. What was the moment like as you and your team were watching the network TV broadcast and the name Robert Morris flashed up in the brackets?
Well, you know what, it's a lifelong memory. I mean, it's, you know, you work so hard all year long and some guys for years, you know, to hear your name called on Selection Sunday and, you know, the feeling's a little bit indescribable. You know, it's something that is just brings so much pride and so much joy to you. It was a great, great moment. I know our guys will, you know, remember it for as long as they live. And, you know, it's, you can say with a lot of pride that you were a member of a team that played in the NCAA tournament.
And there's no doubt about that, that you are, in fact, in the tournament. This is the play-in games are part of the first round officially. And certainly not to take anything away from this, but, you know, being in the play-in game as the Colonials are, is it kind of a slap in the face in a way? I mean, in terms of when you compare it to a team that's going to that second round that doesn't have to, as it's termed, play their way in. Does it make it different in any way?
Absolutely not. You know, I don't think you could try and even convince our guys that it would be any different than being automatically in that second round. You know, our guys are excited to continue to play. There's 351 teams that start the year as Division I teams, and there's only 68 that get to be a part of the NCAA tournament. So, you know, we are full-fledged members of that tournament. We are excited to do so, and we're looking forward to, you know, competing on Wednesday night against North Florida.
And you really had to battle to get that automatic bid that comes with the Northeast Conference Championship. In the first half against St. Francis, it looked like you might be heading to a loss. What did you say to your players at halftime?
You know what? You know, we just talked about kind of getting back to doing what we do. You know, we talked about cleaning up, you know, a couple things from a rebounding perspective and, you know, moving the ball a little bit more. And I thought our guys came out and they really raised their level of intensity in that second half and, you know, really took control of the game. And it was really, really, you know, great thing to see as a coach. And, you know, they really responded and they really played well together and they played for each other. And so it was absolutely terrific. You know, it was great to see. And, you know, I was really happy for those guys and proud of the way that they performed and, you know, the way that they stayed and played together.
How hard is it, Coach, to kind of take that deep breath, because the guys are out there, And they want to win badly. The dream of a lifetime is at stake. It's important to them. It's important to you. And things aren't going the way that you want them to. So in that moment, in that eye of the storm, how do you kind of get everybody under control and back to doing things the way that you know that they can?
Well, and I think that's exactly what you said is you take that deep breath. You know, you take that deep breath and you sit there and you say, okay, what do we need to do to be successful? And let's focus on doing that. And you know, you can't all of a sudden turn it into a gigantic task. It's got to be, you know, talking about, you know, one possession at a time of getting a stop, getting a rebound, taking a great shot, and really break it down to the simpler parts. And that a lot of times that's where, you know, the game is won with those simple details that, you know, we weren't taking care of earlier in the game that we really started to take care of as we moved on. And, you know, we've experienced guys who have been in a lot of different situations, and so they knew there was still a lot of time left for us to play better and do the things we needed to do. And that's exactly the kind of the mindset that they had. And, you know, like I said, they just needed to do it a little bit quicker, a little bit faster, a little bit harder, and that's exactly what they were able to do.
I interviewed Kurt Rambis of the Lakers after they lost a 7-game series to the Celtics because they got out-rebounded. And at halftime of that St. Francis game, Robert Morris was getting out-rebounded. What Rambis said is that rebounding is about who wants it more. So how did you go about, you know, conjuring up that desire in your players at halftime and making them, you know, kind of go that extra inch, that extra inch in the leap, in the vertical, you know, off the hardwood to get up on that glass and pull those basketballs away?
Yeah, it was, you know, and it was something we had talked about, you know, heading into the game. Obviously, we knew rebounding would be a big part of it. And in the beginning of the game, you know, St. Francis was the team that they were hitting us first. They were the ones, you know, being the aggressor. They were the ones attacking the ball. They were the ones, you know, boxing us out, you know, creating their space to rebound. And you know, really that's how a lot of their offense was created. And so, you know, to start the second half, we did a much, when we took control of the game, we did a really incredible job of not allowing them, you know, those offensive rebounds. And that's what we talked about at halftime. Thinking first, hitting first, reacting first, being the more aggressive team. You know, pursuing the basketball until you get it. And we had done some drills in days leading up where we simulated what they would face. And, you know, we talked to them about, hey, we did this for the last 3 days. We did these drills. We've done them all year long, you know, rebounding against multiple people, putting them in difficult situations, disadvantaged situations, and expecting them to be able to come up with the rebound anyway. And we reminded them of all the work that they put in and how many times they'd been in situations like this. And, you know, they went out and responded.
Robert Morris is the only Pittsburgh team going to the NCAA tournament this year. How much does that help in terms of the bragging rights with, say, recruiting against Pitt and Duquesne and maybe even West Virginia?
You know, we don't come across, you know, recruiting against Pitt very often or Duquesne. You know, we kind of have our own, you know, players that we target. But, you know, it's definitely a sense of pride that our guys can walk around knowing that, you know, they're the only Division I team here in the city that's been able to, you know, make it to the NCAA tournament. And, you know, our guys, you know, they socialize a lot with the guys at Duquesne or the guys at Pitt, and, you know, they see them in summer leagues and things like that. So, you know, it'll be great for them. And we're constantly, as a program, always attempting to carve out, you know, more recognition, more respect for our team and for our program and our university. And, you know, this is a great step in that direction.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Andy Toole. He's the head basketball coach at Robert Morris. The team is headed to the NCAA basketball tournament later this week. They get underway in their first-round game on Wednesday. Coach, you're playing North Florida. What do you know about your opponent?
We know a lot about them, actually. We've been able to watch a bunch of film, and you know they're a very excellent offensive team. They have great length. They're a team that makes a lot of threes, takes a lot of threes, shoot them at a high percentage, and so that'll be a concern for us. And they have a lot of size and length. These guys are extremely versatile in how they're able to make plays and play close to the basket, play far away from the basket. And, you know, so we've been able to learn a lot. We went over some of the stuff this morning with our team to prepare them for the game and for our opponent. And, you know, we'll have some more preparation, you know, later today as well as tomorrow. And I think, you know, by the time the game comes, our guys will have a good understanding of what they need to accomplish to win.
I understand North Florida, they say it's the team that lives by the three-point shot and dies by the three-point shot. So, how do you defend against that?
You know, I think it's just being alert and urgent on all their catches, you know, making sure their shooters don't have space to get clean looks. make those guys put the ball on the floor and, you know, try and score in other ways, not just catching and being able to shoot open threes. So it's going to take a lot of effort. It's going to take a lot of intensity, and it's going to take, you know, a lot of urgency, you know, on the flight of the ball, you know, in different situations, making sure that we're moving and covering all the areas that we need to cover.
And in terms of your game planning, and you just kind of went over a good bit of it, but, you know, what happens from the moment that, like last night, all the guys are gathered together watching on TV and you find out who you're playing and what night it is and where you'll be playing. So from that moment until the opening tip-off on Wednesday, what does it look like for you in terms of making travel arrangements and just, you know, getting everybody to that point where they're as ready as they can be by tip-off on Wednesday?
Yeah, you know, it's definitely a thing where there's a scramble. You find out who you're playing. You know, my director of basketball operations, Dave Richards, does an excellent job. And he automatically jumps on the phone with the NCAA, and they start doing all the travel plans. And, you know, then my staff and our film guys, you know, start putting together, you know, all the stats that we need and all the information we need to be able to watch them and break down, you know who our opponent will be, put our game plan together and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's as soon as you hear that selection and everyone starts yelling and screaming, it's time for the staff to get to work. And, you know, that's what our guys did last night. And, you know, I think we've been able to get a really good handle on our opponent.
And are you getting enough sleep?
We'll worry about that at the end of the year. we can at this point in time, we can sacrifice a little sleep for preparation and, you know, making sure that our guys are, you know, in the best possible situation to be successful.
Now, if Robert Morris wins, you'll play Duke in the second round. I suppose there's nothing. I know you don't want to look too far ahead, but Coach, I'm sure you're thinking a little bit about the idea of matching strategy with the legendary Mike Krzyzewski. What about that?
We haven't even got there yet. You know, obviously the media like that story, and, you know, friends and family obviously point that out. But we know the challenge we have Wednesday night, so we can't even really, you know, take the time to look ahead until we have the opportunity to really talk about it. And if it happens, great. And it'll be something we'll look forward to.
You know, 2 years ago, Robert Morris hosted and beat Kentucky in the first round of the NIT. We talked to you then. How much does having that kind of high-pressure experience help with this one?
It makes a great impact on it, you know. And, you know, so, we beat Kentucky 2 years ago. Last year, we beat St. John's in the first round of the NIT. And, you know, we have guys that are experienced in these kind of games, you know, these high-pressure tournament atmosphere postseason games. Obviously, our Northeast Conference experience this year, I think, will help us going on the road and winning at St. Francis Brooklyn in a really difficult environment, you know, where we had to stay together and we had to really rely on our preparation. And, you know, so I think all those experiences will be things that we can draw on as we go into the game on Wednesday night.
And, Coach, just about 30 seconds or so left, but you're going to be playing, again, North Florida on Wednesday. Their coach, Matthew Driscoll, is a Pittsburgh native. And he undoubtedly is going to be familiar with the Colonials. What are your thoughts about the fact that he's going to know pretty much a lot about you guys?
Yeah, you know what? The world of college basketball is so interconnected, and, you know, there's so many, you know, twists and turns that go along the way. And, you know, I've gotten to meet Coach Driscoll on a couple of occasions, and we've talked about Pittsburgh, and, you know, he's done a great job at North Florida. So it'll be an interesting side story, you know, to the game. But I think both of us understand that the most important thing is how well we can prepare our teams and then how well they can go out and perform.
It'll be the Colonials of Robert Morris University taking on North Florida, a play-in game in the NCAA tournament Wednesday night in Dayton, Ohio. Our guest has been Robert Morris head coach Andy Toole. Coach, thank you so much for taking time to join us. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. Before we wrap up today's show, we'd like to say a very fond farewell to our assistant producer during the 3 years this show has been in existence, Heather McLean. We would not have been as successful without her efforts. Heather, thank you so much, and good luck in the future. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.